are, as a reminder, we've talked about the seven periods. We have gone through the years of preparation. We've talked about the early Judean ministry. And where is it again that we're going to find the early Judean ministry? In the book of John. Okay, so John is the only one of the Gospels recording the early Judean ministry, right? And so we've gone through, and this occurred right after the point where Satan tempts Jesus in the wilderness, and we spent some time in John chapter 2 and 1 and 2 and chapter 3. And chapter 4 was the story with the woman at the well and the Samaritan woman at the well. All of that is very sequential. All of that is very easy chronologically. And that made for a fairly easy study. So we get to the end of this Judean ministry, and Jesus moves into Galilee. So now we get into the Galilean ministry, and sometimes in the listing you'll hear the kids say the Great Galilean Ministry. And great because of what? Give me some thoughts on that. Why would we use the term Great Galilean Ministry? Multitudes following him, that's right. Some other aspects you can think of? A lot of miracles being done. Exactly. Okay. Any other aspects?
Teaching.
Yes. Yes. The profound teachings and the parables that are being presented. And then another thing to consider is just the duration. This is the best that we can tell, a pretty large segment of the overall ministry of Christ. I mean, the overall span of his ministry, we say, is a little over 3 years, correct? So about 3.5 years, somewhere in that range. And if we look at, although difficult to pin down, it's estimated that the Galilean ministry was probably somewhere between 18 to 21 months. And so a pretty good chunk of this, of his overall ministry, is in this Galilean ministry. So that's something to bear in mind. Okay, so that also, we're going to be spending a lot of time in the Great Galilean Ministry as we go through this study of the Gospels. Okay? Now, one of the challenges that I face, and you may as well, but it's definitely a challenge to me, is that with this large section of the Galilean ministry, I like to piece things together. And I've mentioned that before. I like to find, okay, now he did this, and then he went over and did that. But you can't do that very well with the Galilean ministry. And you also will find yourself jumping from one of the Gospels to the next one, and this one goes over here and that one, and sometimes can be kind of, at least has been for me, a little bit overwhelming and confusing, and I feel lost as to what's happening. And so, again, I say my challenge is I want to try as best I can to sort things out, to help me get a better grasp of the events that took place, when and where, if possible. But in cases where you can't do that, in cases where you can't be certain about what happened next, I think it's a good thing to recognize that there, at least, what do you do in that situation? You know, we're not going to try to bury ourselves in the fact that, well, you can't be sure about that or be dogmatic about one thing or the other when there's not any certainty. But what we do want to do is get, well, what is the overriding events that are going on? And I think that was really helpful for me to see as we were looking through Bob and Sandra Waldron's book, to recognize that more importantly, it's good to see the history progressing throughout his life and throughout this period of time. Because we've been talking about, okay, well, the preparation period, the beginning ministry where he first starts. But inside the Galilean ministry, we can see movement of the course of events ultimately bringing him where? You know, bringing him to the cross. And so the first things that we're going to see as we go into the Galilean ministry, we're going to start seeing some really profound miracles happening right up front. We don't immediately start into the parables. We don't immediately start into hearing the specific teachings of Jesus right off the bat. You see some miracles being performed. Well, what is it that miracles always do for us? They confirm his word. Even though we don't have the word being just spelled out in these teachings and parables, and what confirms the word, but it also does what? Proves what? Who he is. Proves that he's the Son of God. And so there's just some very profound things right off that are attention getters about who he is and manifesting himself as the Son of God. And so I think we're going to see that in these first sections as we go through them. Now, after that, we're going to see Jesus spending time with his disciples, the 12 disciples, and a lot of teaching there. We should recognize that as we carry on, that he's training them, bringing them to an understanding about the kingdom. He does that all the way up to the point of the cross and even after the resurrection, teaching them about the kingdom. And so there's this constant training that begins with those, because when he's gone, they're going to be the ones carrying things on. So we're going to see that right in the middle of the Galilean ministry as well. Okay, and then toward the end of the Galilean ministry, we actually see signs of it right off the bat. But we're going to see a strengthening and an increase in the hostilities that are going to be shown toward Jesus. And that we're going to start seeing the Pharisees and the leaders of the Jews getting more and more upset about the fact that people are listening to Jesus and they're following Jesus and they're, you know, drawn to him and they're turning to him, and this is a threat to them. Why is it that the Jews put Jesus on the cross? It was for what? For envy, right? And so we're going to see that ramp up as well. And so, again, even though we're not going to be able to pin things down chronologically, like my brain likes to work, there's still going to be a great deal of things that we need to kind of step back and don't lose focus of this progression of history. So we can see the things unfolding, even though we may not necessarily have a specific chronological timeline that we can pin down. Okay. Questions or comments to add about these things? Introductory comments. That by the
time John starts writing about Jesus or the other apostles, he's done went through from being baptized up to the wilderness and went through the temptations before he collected the 12 apostles.
Yes, Jesus would have been through the temptations before collecting the 12 apostles.
Right.
Yes.
Because he left from John. Because Paul always said before John starts writing about him,
Okay.
That may not make sense or may make sense to a lot of people, but it opens up my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, well, where Leon left off, we were in John chapter 4. And he told me, he said, I set this up perfectly for you. So here we go. I'll try not to fumble. Now, we were... the woman at the well, and then toward... he spent a couple of days in Samaria teaching them. And then he moves to Galilee, at verse 44 and verse 45. And this is where we made the point about the fact that the Galileans had received him in verse 45, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they had also gone to the feast. Okay, so we had, but how much has he done in Galilee to this point, from in standpoint of miracles? In Galilee, how many miracles has he performed? Just the earlier in Cana of Galilee, that first one with the water to wine, and that was before he went to Jerusalem. Okay? And so then he returns from there, and now he's back in Galilee. But the Galileans, they saw what he did in Jerusalem. Now, he did a lot of stuff in Jerusalem while he was there. And so this captures their attention, of course. Okay, so in verse 46, so Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water to wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Okay, so simple map up here. Just keep in mind, Cana of Galilee is approximately in this area here, which would be in the hill country, and then Capernaum here. Okay, so we've got the nobleman from Capernaum, and Jesus is in Cana at this point. And so the nobleman comes to Cana, having heard that he's there, and he's asking him to heal his son. Okay? Now, Jesus said in verse 48, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe. Okay? And there had already been people that were just interested in seeing a sign. Do you remember what happened in Jerusalem when he overturned the tables and they were coming and, well, show us a sign to see who you're from? Well, that was their primary interest, was seeing these signs. But here the nobleman says in verse 49, sir, come down before my child dies. And so he's already indicating that he's coming with belief. He knows that Jesus can do that. He's confident that Jesus can heal his son. And so he's not approaching Jesus from that perspective of just wanting to see some sign. And so Jesus says, go your way, your son lives. And he believes the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he goes his way. All right, and so as it turns out through the rest of this section, he comes to find out that, yes, at the, you know, he's asking his servants and the people of his household, at what point did my son, you know, revive? And he realizes it's right at the time that Jesus told him, go and your son lives. And so he believes, and his whole household believes as a result of this. And verse 54 says, this again is the second sign of that Jesus did when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. So it's the second sign in Galilee. He'd done a bunch of other stuff down in Judea and in Jerusalem already. Okay, so now, from there, now we're up in Galilee. We're going to move to the story in Nazareth. Okay, so turn to Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4. Jesus is in Nazareth. Now, Nazareth is also in Galilee. Okay, so he's still up in this region. But what is, okay, this is obvious. What's particular about Nazareth? What's of interest of Nazareth? Is where he's raised, okay? And so he is in verse 16. It says, so Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah, and when he had opened the book, he found the place where it is written, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Then he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. So you can imagine thinking about this. Here is Nazareth. Think of how often Jesus had come to this synagogue in Nazareth, years growing up and regularly worshiping here. And now here he comes, common to most people, right? People see Jesus, well, this is, ultimately, what do they say? Well, isn't this Joseph's son? And so here he comes back where it was such a familiar place to him, and this is just very customary, and he reads this passage and says, today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And it's his declaration that I'm this person. I'm the one that this passage in Isaiah is speaking of. And so, you know, at first everyone is thinking, oh, wow, this is Joseph's son. But then there's a little bit of, also a little bit of disdain, you know, that, well, this is just Joseph's son. This can't be anything special here. And I think that this is kind of the background where Jesus says that, you know, I tell you the truth, there's no prophet is accepted in his hometown. And he says that he starts talking about the fact that there, let's go back and think about the times of Elijah and the times of Elisha. Let's look at history. Is this true in history? And he says that in those days, there were many widows in Israel, verse 25, that when the heavens was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a great famine throughout all the land, and a lot of people were in need, but to none of them was Elijah sent except to Zarephath, in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow, to someone outside the land, a Gentile. And then many lepers were in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them were cleansed except Naaman the Syrian, a Gentile. And so he's driving that point home. And as he refers to Gentiles, who were the objects of blessings in those days, rather than Israel being the ones to receive those blessings, this makes them mad. In fact, furious. And so they were filled with wrath. And in verse 29, they rose up and they thrust him out of the city. They led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. So they're ready to kill him, because they're found guilty of rejecting even the one that's prophesied in their midst. But to no avail, right? Is that fascinating to you, that he just walks through their midst, just passes right through them untouched? And I just wonder what that would have looked like. You know, they've got him here, and then suddenly they don't have him, and he just moves right along. And what would that be a part of? We've been talking about this. His time had not yet come. This wasn't the time yet. Yes, people were going to get angry, and they're going to get angry all along, and it's going to ramp up, but his time had not yet come. There was much to do, many things to teach, many things to prepare before everything would be just right. Okay, so Jesus is rejected in Nazareth. So we're moving along now. So he moves from Nazareth. He's not going to live and reside in Nazareth any longer. He's going to move where? I'm sorry? To Capernaum. Okay? So now he's moving to Capernaum. We've already pointed out there on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. And this is really where he's going to end up being often, and where he'll stay. But he'll leave Capernaum and do some preaching and teaching in different areas, and then he'll come back. And then he'll leave again and come back. And we're going to see that often. But Capernaum is almost like a home base, so to speak. And so that's something to keep in mind, of the significance of Capernaum. It's kind of a central area that he could work from. Okay, so when he gets to Capernaum, let's see, if you turn to Matthew chapter 4, okay, we'll spend just a few moments there. Yes, sir. Yeah. So the rejection was for the things that he began to claim. In other words, so like I said, they were ready, willing to listen to him for the reputation that he had. They knew him, and that wasn't really the issue, but rather the things that he started to proclaim and declare. That's right. Okay. Now, Matthew chapter 4, and verse 12, it says, "Now when Jesus had heard that John had been put to prison, he departed to Galilee." And that's really talking about earlier. So he'd left for Galilee. Now, verse 13, "And leaving Nazareth," which we just read about in Luke chapter 4, "leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum." So here in Matthew, it doesn't really tell the reason why he left Nazareth, but Luke 4 expands on it. Okay? So he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. And from that time, Jesus began to preach and say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And so why did he go to Capernaum? Well, Luke explains that he was rejected in Nazareth. But why else, and what was important, why did he go to Capernaum? To fulfill prophecy, okay? And the prophecy about Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, what's interesting about this? Why is that prophecy? This is Isaiah chapter 9. What does it mean? I mean, why Zebulun and Naphtali? What does it say of them? Yes, exactly. And so they're on the north portion here of Israel, and the Assyrians came from the north, and so they really got the first hit from Assyria and just laid waste on them. And so that was in a period of sadness and darkness. And so it's saying of them that the people who sat in darkness, but they seen a great light. So even though they were, there's a lot of memory there and a lot of history of some bad things that have happened there. But now, look at the great things that are going to happen in this place more than anywhere else. And so that's a pretty special thing to remember. And just, you know, even though it was just a dark area, this is going to be where God would shine his light brightest through the teaching of Jesus. Okay. In survey form, moving on. Okay. Now, we're going to talk briefly about the fact that Jesus calls his four disciples to him. And so let's look at the book of Mark this time, in Mark chapter 1 and verse 16. Okay? Mark chapter 1 and verse 16. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And they immediately left their nets and followed him. And when he had gone a little farther from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him. Okay, so, here you have Jesus walking along and he sees them fishing and says, "Follow me," and they just, okay. And they just drop what they're doing and they follow him. And growing up, I thought, wow, that's amazing. And I've heard a lot of people say, that's just, what a great faith, you know, to just drop everything and go. But what do we know already?
They'd already seen him
and been with him. They knew Jesus. And so this wasn't just the strangest thing for them to drop what they were doing. They knew what they were following after. And that's not to discount them or discredit them in their actions. But, you know, it does help to I guess, recognize just the reality of the situation. They go, oh, there's Jesus. And he says, come on, let's go. And they go. Okay, so now is basically they're leaving what they do. And this is going to be the beginning of that concentrated teaching where they spend all of their time with them and they're going to start learning some things. And this is what we talked about earlier, that we see the progression of the history. We see first Jesus with these miracles and signs that proclaim who he is, And then we also see him taking up his disciples and begin the teaching. This is the beginning of that, that he's going to start taking these disciples aside and following after him and teaching them. Okay? So, questions, comments? We're at less than 2 minutes, right? Go ahead. Right, right. And we've already had kind of that John declaring to his disciples that, you know, this is the bride and the bridegroom's friend, and, you know, it's time for him to increase and me to decrease. So, right. Okay, so the bell just rang. Continue on. I'm going to be here next Wednesday, and we're going to pick up from here and keep trying to move forward, hopefully in survey format. Okay?